Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at the League of Education Voters. Chris Rakedahl was born and raised in Snohomish and is the youngest of eight children. He graduated summa cum laude from Washington State University with a bachelor's degree in social studies and earned a master's degree in public administration from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He coached both youth and adult soccer for several years, volunteered as a local city planning commissioner, and served as a trustee for the College Spark Washington Foundation for 6 years. His professional career has been devoted to public education. Chris has worked as a high school history teacher, local school board member, state legislator, and budget and education policy executive for our state's community and technical college system. In November 2016, Chris was elected as Washington's 16th state superintendent. Chris and his wife Kim lived in historic Tumwater with their two children, Carter and Kennedy. Superintendent Rakedahl, last month you outlined your long-term vision for K-12 education and framework for satisfying the state Supreme Court's ruling in McCleary versus Washington. In phase one, 2017 to 2019, performance improvements and McCleary framework, you'd like to see the legislature decide on a clear definition of basic education and the state's portion of compensation for our educators. Beyond that, the state would need to provide targeted support beyond basic education for schools with large performance gaps between student demographics. And you would like to move the 11th grade assessment to 10th grade so that test results will inform students' graduation pathway. In phase two, which is 2019 to 2021, research and policy transition, you would like to create meaningful pathways to high school graduation, paying all dual credit fees for our students, and creating more opportunities for parents and guardians to engage in their child's education, particularly with key investments in technology. And in phase three, 2021 to 2023, comprehensive K-12 redesign, you're proposing large transformational changes, which include dual language acquisition beginning in kindergarten, longer K-8 school days and a longer school year, longer lunch breaks, adequate recess times, and universal early learning access, among others. Where do you start? I mean, this is quite a plan. And how do you plan on engaging stakeholders to accomplish the plan?
Thanks for having me again back on the program. So you start in the first biennium, and the legislature's obviously put in an enormous amount of work over the last several months trying to solve the fiscal side of phase one, which is really satisfying the court, making sure that basic ed is clearly defined and then funded by the state, and then allowing local resources that we believe should still be available to supplement basic education. They're doing their part, and let's hope we get a decision here soon before we are imperiled by a shutdown that will really do damage to a lot of public employees. Our part of that was to try to strike a powerful compromise in the assessment conversation, because we're trying to set up a long-term environment where assessments aren't about denying diplomas, but offered early enough in the secondary system that they inform what we can do to intervene and bring students both up to standard and articulate really powerful 11th and 12th grade pathways for students. So they're using the last couple years of high school to launch themselves to post-secondary. Every student should really be thinking about life after high school. For many, that will be straight to work. For even more, it'll be something more than a high school diploma, but less than a bachelor's degree. And probably for about a third of them, it will be a bachelor's degree or higher. We need every student thinking about their passion and their vision much earlier. So our compromise we put forward includes a high school and beyond plan with a lot more detail and rigor brought to middle schoolers, so they're thinking about this work early. So we feel like this first phase has gone exceedingly well, assuming the legislature provides ample funding or at least gets pretty close, because we think we're in a pretty good position on the assessment bill to just make more rational sense of assessments, put them in their proper place. Obviously, the second phase, as you just indicated, involves some policy work that the legislature needs to start to put in place that gives us the best shot at developing these pathways. So we know what going to college looks like. We've kind of been sticking every student on that conveyor belt for a long time, and it's got some downside risk to it. Students who are not interested in a university pathway are still sort of pushed to Algebra II pre-calculus, and they're still pushed to academic routes, and we're starving the rest of our economy of a workforce that's desperately needed and, quite frankly, pays tremendous resources. So whether it's in the trades or whether it's in vet tech or nursing assistant, these career and tech ed programs are really powerful, but the system's kind of clunky right now about making it really clear on how a student can execute down that pathway, get dual credit along the way, and make a seamless transition to post-secondary. That's some of the work we need to do over the next couple of years. Part of it will be incumbent upon us at OSPI to lead. A lot of it will be working with local districts and industry locally to figure it out, and there's some policy work left for the legislature. The third phase, as you indicated, is really making sure that we ultimately launch something post-McCleary. Satisfying the court is not our goal. It's not exciting. It doesn't motivate voters and taxpayers. They want to know what's going to be fundamentally different. And so as we looked around the rest of the globe, it's pretty clear that most of our competitors have longer school years. That can come in the form of longer days in the current framework. It can come in the form of a longer school year. But we have about 1,000 instructional hours, and we think we would be well suited to try to move that to 1,100 to 1,200 instructional hours throughout a course of a year. That would bring back the liberty of recess and play and adequate lunch and teacher professional development time. And we think it would accommodate this very powerful global notion of students learning a second language as a normal part of basic education, not as this thing you sort of have to do in high school to satisfy a university admissions requirement, but really embracing language early. Lots of research on how powerful that is, not just in language, but how much that advances students' critical thinking in math and science and other areas. So it's an ambitious agenda. It is meant to be a little scary and audacious. People can't imagine even solving a $2 billion a year McCleary problem, and we're saying we're going to do that, and that's phase one. And we have 6 years to go find another $2 billion per year, which is going to take risk and sacrifice by all of us. But if we do that, you can begin to imagine a K-12 system that is number one in the country and moving on to becoming very globally competitive, with students thinking very globally, pathways individually tailored for them, and teachers more adequately compensated for this longer investment of their time during the school year. Parent engagement becomes powerful. We don't presume that we have all the answers today. We know the policy framework that would make us very successful, but now we have time to go get to folks in the system, educators, principals, superintendents, counselors, parents along the way who have some joy about this and some worry about it, researchers along the way, and of course, policymakers. So now starts the long work of really inviting people into these conversations to flesh them out.
So what can we as stakeholders and parents do to make this happen?
Well, obviously the most powerful thing we do in this state is engage our local communities. And so where we have pockets of excellence already, whether it be in language or bell schedules or instructional practices or pathways or CTE routes, we know there's really cool things happening all over the state, but they're more in pockets as opposed to systemic. So we need parents really engaged at the local level saying, I want to know what my school does and does not do really well, because I'm hearing about these things that are considered best practices or really national or international benchmarks. How do I do more of that? So I'm always biased to tell parents and community leaders that while we want to get the policy right at the state level, the most powerful thing you can do is be in front of your school board, asking them for the resources and the programming that you need. I just think that's enormously important, and we should never lose that local element to this thing at all. The other thing is start thinking about the system we have today, the system you experienced when you were a kid, and if you can imagine all the transformation that we've experienced in our 21st century economy and technology, you got to kind of imagine that the school system's going to have to evolve with that. Our teachers are working their butts off keeping up with technology and the diversity of our classrooms and facing a growing number of students in poverty. Our teachers do a really remarkable job trying to stay up, but the one element every superintendent of schools will tell you is time is the big factor. And trying to do more in the same 180-day school year, 6.5 hours a day, eventually breaks. And you're seeing it now because we're taking away recess time from kids, we're taking away lunchtime, we're taking away professional development from teachers. We're privatizing that, if you will, by putting it on the backs of folks in their private lives. So students are taking home enormously more homework in elementary school than they did before. Teachers are taking more of the work home. And that has equity complications. Mm-hmm. If you're not going to do the core work of school in school and you shift that to the home, there are families who are more able to do that with private resources, and there are families who will really struggle. So there's an equity conversation here when we talk about expanding the school year and doing things differently. And parents should be pushing at the state level and the local level to see that that's deployed in a way that empowers every family.
You mentioned equity, and I think that's a huge issue in Washington State. We saw the data that said that our achievement and opportunity gaps are growing here. How does your plan handle that? What does it do to address the growing gaps?
This is a really exciting time for our state because we're putting out a 6-year vision that squarely focuses on this question. It's about resources and time and programs and pathways and interventions, but it's also a time where we're rewriting our accountability system. We're just 2 months away from submitting to the governor for his review our ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act Accountability Plan that we owe the feds, and then we owe it to them by the middle of September. We're creating a dashboard right now that's the most powerful thing I've seen. Every single academic indicator that will go in our achievement index has a lot of research behind it, and then we blow that up in different ways so that parents can pick any particular issue, whether it's math or language or ninth grade failure or dual credit programs or a host of other things, and they can look at that by race, ethnicity for their school, not just their district or the state, but right down to their school. And so suddenly we're creating tools for every parent to look at and say, I thought my school was doing really well. They probably are in aggregate. But when you disaggregate and you uncover and unmask what's happening to subpopulations, it compels you to get back to your local school board and say, we are a good school district, but we've got this population of students that are still really struggling. And we've sort of been hiding it in this slightly growing graduation rate for years, but there's underlying problems here. We think it's our job to expose that through research and data analytics and visualization, and then advocate for the resources. It is very powerful, though, for communities to be engaged locally to then say, now that we've got more resources, they're solving McCleary, they're fixing the testing problem, they're now bringing the research, what are we doing as a district to close gaps? That's our job. We're pretty excited about the time that we're in.
Will there be workshops on local communities on how they can advocate for themselves?
You know, it's a very good question. We don't typically get into the advocacy side. We've got to be awfully careful as a state agency. What we're going to do is have plenty of workshops and plenty of opportunities to teach people about our new data analytic tools so they understand how to use them and put them in proper context, right? They don't solve anything. They open up the world. They open up people's understanding of strengths and weaknesses. I think we have allies all over the state who it is incumbent upon them to say, now what do we do with that? In a way that's positive, that builds momentum, that doesn't vilify, but says, okay, now that we've identified this, what's next? Your organization does this well. I would argue our teachers union does a very good job trying to empower their teachers to understand this. One America, we've got these really amazing groups across the state who sometimes see the world a little differently, but they get access to communities in different ways, and it's really powerful over the next couple of years that they figure out strategies to empower folks that are about a solution and not just, you know, sort of vilifying the existing system.
Well, when the three phases are done and you have transformed the schools, what would the new schools look like?
Yeah, so I think there's always a powerful notion of a physical presence, right? Our local community schools are often our community gathering spaces, and I would not expect some giant transformation of where students go. Hopefully they're still very much in local community schools, but I think you can expect very targeted interventions in populations that need additional help. The policymakers this year are landing on that and part of their solution. They want to drive more money, not just to quote-unquote failing schools, but to very specific students who need additional support. And part of this plan is saying, let's take that to the next level. They need more time, they need more resources, they need more counseling and advising, more parent engagement, and they need to think about pathways differently. It's not just sit in the class, get the credit, and everything will be okay. What specifically moves you and makes you passionate about where you're going? That kind of work you can expect differently. So the growing customization of schools to students, but keeping it very public, keeping it highly visible about the results, and hopefully with data analytics that show continued progress. We are graduating more students. Our tribal students graduated at a faster rate than anybody else last year, so still huge gaps, but we're closing those gaps. Now it's time to kind of blow the cover off of this and get into a lot more detail. Our community should expect schools that are more involved, kids who have a higher obligation of more time in their year, and maybe even a very different calendar. Again, it's mostly about instructional time and not the state presuming what that looks like, but you will see some districts begin to evolve their calendar beyond the 180-day agrarian world we've been in for 130 years.
Yeah, the world is certainly changing. And one thing that we've seen is that by 2020, 70% of all family wage jobs will require some sort of post-secondary degree or credential. How will the plan prepare students to get those credentials and degrees?
Yeah, again, holding hard with our standards, developing readiness all the way in pre-kindergarten, making sure that students have the critical thinking skills and communication skills That's the power of this. It's not about picking a path or tracking kids or predetermining a job, because kids are going to change their careers dozens of times and their jobs multiple dozens of times. It's about, are we building the critical thinking skills so that they're adaptive? They can move from one industry to another or one passion to another. We think we're doing that in this plan by resourcing it differently, focusing on standards, making assessments meaningful again, not as this high stakes pass-fail thing, but using it to figure out where students need additional intervention. And then this whole idea of building pathways and redesigning the high school system so it's 9th and 10th grade is really core years, and 11th and 12th grade where students can really begin to dive into a pathway. This is how you get students excited about things that have historically been under the radar. We should have students just as excited to build the high-rise as be the CEO in it, just as excited to manufacture the aircraft as it is to design the part. And I think we kind of got this out of balance for a while. We had this every student to a university. It wasn't good for kids who weren't interested in that, and we now know it's really disastrous for employers who need students up and down the economic spectrum. These are exciting times. They're going to require all of us to be willing to take risk for students in different ways.
Where do you see the barriers? What are the obstacles that might be preventing this from becoming reality?
Resources are always a question. Even when the court was breathing down the neck of the legislature, it's taken a lot of bipartisan work just to get to a court solution. But let's be honest, they have added billions of dollars in the last couple years, all day kindergarten, class size reduction, transportation. They are going to add billions more this year. They are doing their jobs, and I know it's not popular to say that, and lots of people want to beat up the legislature because it's not fast enough, but they've moved significantly on this question of education funding. We're challenging them to go beyond that. Don't just satisfy basic ed as it's been defined in the past. Think about the system you want going forward. So there's a resource question, and then there's a tradition question. Everyone knows we have to intervene differently for students, and the 21% who aren't graduating with their peers look very differently than the 79% who are. They're more likely to be poverty, English language learners, students with disabilities, and students of color. That means we have to be willing to do things differently. And it doesn't mean sitting at home and yelling at the TV because the legislature isn't adding a dollar. That's part of it. The other part is, am I willing to do something differently? Am I willing to have a longer school year or to drive resources in communities that need it more than my community needs it? Everyone has to have this question of, what sacrifice would I make to create an education system that isn't just top of the U.S., but top of the world? And that's the fundamental question we're asking people to think about.
Will you be launching some sort of campaign to explain what the vision could look like and where people can insert themselves to actually overcome these barriers?
Well, we'll put more of our resources in the question of diving deep into the policy and diving deep into engaging people who have the research and the background and really the critical thinking around this. So you don't have to be expert at cognitive gaps to know if you're a community of color, my kid's not being served equally. So we would expect to spend most of our energy diving into these questions that have to be solved as we build the policy agenda towards the ultimate six-year vision. There will be some media around it for sure. We will do lots of media every time we present another data visualization and another way for people to sort of uncover what's happening. We continue to put media attention around those, but we won't spend a lot of resources just sort of splashing out the six-year vision. We did that, and now it's time to execute.
Well, you've been on the job now just about 6 months. What's your favorite part of being OSPI?
Well, it's a great question. Finding the balance between advancing a system but letting it be local. So we can advance a system with more resources and more vision and more policy and more data, but at some point in time, a student in Mukilteo, a student in Yakima, a student in Toppenish in Vancouver and Spokane, they experience school by showing up to a classroom with a teacher who is excited to teach them. And if we ever lose the fact that we are working for local schools and local kids and parents and local teachers, then we're in trouble. So finding that balance is really fun, which means I'm putting lots of energy into designing and redesigning OSPI and in the legislature, but I'm also still traveling the state in communities, listening to what they need. Striking that balance is important for effect, but it's what lifts the soul, remembering why you're doing it every day.
Chris Rakedahl is the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Chris, thank you so much for letting me drop by.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you.